The Truth News Network. Thought, not just talk. Where the truth sets us all free. TNN.
The Truth News Network.
And your host is Dan Newman.
Hey there, everyone. We made it through the first half of the week. Aren't you glad? I hope the first half was good. The second half is even better. I'm glad you joined us here today. We're discussing political influence. It's everywhere. We know it is. And political influence's boss is the Grim Reaper. Harvey Weinstein heard his fate from a New York judge on Wednesday. Harvey is old. He's riddled with medical complexities. He's now facing 20-plus years in prison for rape and sexual assault. Without some type of pardon, Harvey will probably die behind bars. That was not supposed to happen to Harvey Weinstein. He, for decades, had significant political influence. No one on earth contributed more money through the years to the Clintons than did Weinstein. Beginning with Bill's first run for the White House, then for Clinton's second term in office, Hillary's Senate campaigns, and then her two runs for president, Harvey Weinstein just handed his wallet over to the pair. But he did more than just that. When he reached his legal maximum in contributions, he began bundling for the Clintons. He is personally responsible for millions of campaign dollars for the Clintons' various campaigns through three decades. In return, he planned to cash in his political chits called influence. Where is Harvey's political influence today? He's going to die in jail. He's at the whim of the Grim Reaper. Influence. Political influence flows through the streets of Washington like floodwaters. It seems today that everything there is for sale, and it all has a price. Members of Congress may not sell their votes on specific issues, but when the lobbyist calls, who 3 years ago got one's grandson an internship that paid 15% more than it should have, that member of Congress is going to take that phone call and is going to listen. The lawmaker sold his or her political influence. In the early 90s, I had just turned a corner with a newly formed company that had taken off after three typical years of struggling to get started. I was an active young guy in our community. I was pretty well known, and I thought I had a promising future. One day, three gentlemen walked into my office to meet with me. All three were good friends. One was a local school superintendent, one was a real estate developer, the other was a longtime state representative who was leaving that office to run for governor. I was surprised but pleased to see those three. They came in unannounced. But I was shocked when I heard the reason for their visit. They wanted me to run to replace the representative in state government. It took me a few moments to come back to earth. I sat in silence for just a minute and felt unexpected nausea rising in my throat. I didn't understand and didn't know then why I said what I said next, but I do know now why. This is when I almost screamed, "There is no way I'll run for that office, and I will never run for any political office." That night, I shared the experience with my wife. She looked at me kind of wide-eyed and asked, "Why'd you say no?" I'd thought it through after the three left, and I reached a conclusion that day in my office for my nausea and my quick declination. I shared this with my wife. "I would always feel obligated to someone if I was a politician, and I don't think I could ever get accustomed to that. Now, I'm not a superhero. I'm not a perfect soul by any means. But after their question and my answer sunk in, I reasoned why I told my wife what I did. I could most definitely not have run a successful and winning campaign for the House of Representatives using just the money I had. There wasn't much money available. A run for that office, any office, would require my asking for campaign contributions. I could not, and I still cannot, envision a scenario in which I would be able to say no to any person who had contributed $1 to my campaign, if and when asked for a favor of any kind." Several years later, I heard Rush Limbaugh respond on air to a caller who asked him pretty much the same thing, why he didn't run for political office. His response was very similar to mine. Now, don't get me wrong. Campaign contributions are necessary in today's political system. There certainly are those who can access the political contribution system well and can then legislate with no arbitrary sense of obligation to supporters who may have given them money. I'm glad there are those public servants, but I didn't think I could be one of those. Do you know what? There's a multi-billion dollar industry that exists for one reason and one reason only: to use money and favors to purchase political influence from American politicians. It's housed principally in law firms and marketing firms, almost all located on K Street, just around the corner from the U.S. Capitol. Let's take a quick look at just one race, the 2016 presidential general election race between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. I want you to listen to these campaign contribution numbers. Hillary Clinton raised $866.6 million from individuals and companies, an additional $201.5 million from super PACs. Listen, folks, that was $1,068,100,000. That's $1 billion, B with a B. Donald Trump raised $453.1 million from individuals and companies, $59 million from super PACs. That's a total of $512.2 million. That's less than half of what Hillary raised. Trump, of that amount, personally donated $100 million. Think about just how much money was contributed to those in the same election who ran for the House and Senate, to candidates for governor, mayor, state legislators, local city council seats, and even dog catchers. The total must have been tens of billions of dollars. That money was contributed from all kind of people, companies, and entities here in the United States. Let me ask this question. Knowing how the process exists, knowing why it exists, and more importantly, knowing that the love of money is the root of all evil, why is this entire process still allowed in the United States? Let's talk for a moment about the process. Now, I'm a strict capitalist. I've started several companies. When doing so, I in advance puzzle through all the obvious obstacles I'm going to face. I determine when moving forward what was my overall objective for the company, how to achieve that objective, and then carefully put in place all the necessary resources for it to come to pass. Those resources included infrastructure, personnel, operating necessities, and of course, capital to power the ship. The beauty and untarnished concept of capitalism worked perfectly in my case. All those companies did not succeed as hoped and planned. But what determined their success or failure had nothing to do with anything but me and how I missed or hit the right stages in building and growing that company. What was at the end of a win and doing so? There was financial freedom, a tremendous sense of accomplishment and value, along with numerous other opportunities. You know what? Politics is not different at all. Someone seizes the same thoughts, ideas, and plans. The same requirements are there to build that idea and make it grow. It requires opportunity, infrastructure, people, that's personnel, operating necessities, and of course, capital. The difference between an entrepreneurial startup company and a life in politics is found in one word. What is a necessity in both? Money. Political capital is raised by creating an environment structured to secure contributions. That environment's usually a combination of funding sources that include individuals, political action committees called PACs, and super PACs, and from the candidate personally. Other than those, campaign contributions are restricted, very restricted. To see just what those restricted contribution sources include, there's a link on the story on our website at this point in the story. Click on it and go to the FEC government website directly to the page that shows you the restrictions. The restrictions are vast and very comprehensive. This process was created to keep as much of the grafted political influence as possible from impacting our elections. Campaign dollars, gotta have it, the single largest energy source to make possible an election victory. So how do we stop all these dollars flowing into elections to, in essence, buy election results? Well, that's been addressed over and over again, year after year, decade after decade, for several hundred years. The most recent solution was campaign reform. total reform seem to be the only way to stop our steady move to an environment in which the candidate with the most money would win every time, every election. Let me throw a monkey wrench into the thinking on that and this entire conversation. Take a couple of minutes to listen with me to George Will, who explains what campaign reform really is.
Campaign finance reform is what it pretends to combat: corruption. Let me say that again, slightly rephrased. Campaign finance reform corrupts the political system it presumes to save from corruption. Now that I've taken the trouble to repeat myself, you may be shaking your head, wondering how I could be so wrong. Don't we want to get money out of politics? Isn't campaign finance reform an inherent good? The late Senator Eugene McCarthy, the iconic liberal politician of the Vietnam War era, didn't think so. McCarthy, a Democrat who represented Minnesota in the Senate from 1959 to 1971, did something unthinkable in 1968. Because of his opposition to the Vietnam War, he challenged a powerful incumbent president for his party's presidential nomination. His challenge to President Lyndon Johnson was possible and potent only because five wealthy liberals who shared McCarthy's opposition to the Vietnam War gave him substantial sums of money. Stuart Mott's $210,000 would be $1.4 million in today's dollars. The five donors' seed money enabled McCarthy to raise $11 million, or $75 million today. But because of campaign finance reform, the most a wealthy quintet could give to help an insurgent against an incumbent today would be $13,000, five times the individual limit of $2,600. McCarthy didn't win the nomination, but he did compel Johnson not to run for a second term. In doing so, McCarthy changed history. But the Democratic Party establishment wasn't happy about it. To stop it from happening again, they pushed for government regulation of political speech. Thus, in reaction to Eugene McCarthy's insurgency, campaign finance reform was born. Not much has changed since then. Whatever their stated intentions, campaign finance laws are not written to protect the public from corrupt politicians. They are written to protect incumbents from anyone who might challenge them. So, not only doesn't campaign finance reform disrupt the status quo, it encases it in cement. All the laws that ever have regulated campaigns or ever will regulate them have had or will have one thing in common. They have been or will be written by incumbent legislators. That is why such laws are presumptively disreputable and usually unconstitutional. But, reformers shout, politicians are bought and sold by big money interests, and we have to stop this. These reformers argue two propositions. One is that corruption is so pervasive and so subtle that it is invisible. They resemble the zealots who say proof of the conspiracy to assassinate President Kennedy is the fact that no proof has been found. Alternatively, reformers argue that corruption is entirely visible everywhere. If politician A votes in a way that pleases contributor B, particularly if contributor B enjoyed access to politician A, that shall be designated corruption. But there is abundant research demonstrating that money almost always moves toward the politician with whom the contributor already agrees. In other words, money is rarely given in order to change a politician's votes. It is given in order to support politicians who already vote the way donors want them to. Nevertheless, reformers increasingly argue, see their justifications for restricting political action committees or PACs, that regulating the timing, amount, and content of political advocacy is necessary to improve the tone of politics. These reformers apparently think that what James Madison, the author of the Bill of Rights, meant when he wrote, "Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech," was really, "Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech unless incumbents think abridgments will help keep them in office." even if it were Congress's business to decide that there is too much money in politics, what does too much mean? In the 2007-2008 election cycle, spending in all campaigns, from city council members up to the presidency, was $8.6 billion, about what Americans spend annually on potato chips. Reformers say that regulation of campaign giving and spending will not only spare our leaders the distraction of the governed, that is, seeking undue influence on government, it also will make us think better of government. But a jaundiced view of government is often sensible, and certainly it is justified by all these campaign regulations, which have become a particularly virulent form of the disease it purports to cure. So, let me repeat myself a third and final time. Campaign finance reform is what it pretends to combat: corruption.
Wow. So is there any way to keep the political influence that results from campaign contributions impacting election results? That's a question of the day. The answer, listen to this, is to eliminate super PACs. The problem in accomplishing that is the United States Supreme Court. The court ruled years ago in a famous case called Citizens United that super PACs could pretty much open the cash register at will to fund elections as they want. A super PAC is a modern breed of a political action committee that's allowed to raise and spend unlimited amounts of money from corporations, unions, individuals, and associations to influence the outcome of state and federal elections. The rise of the super PAC was heralded as the beginning of a new era in politics in which elections would be determined by dollars and cents, the vast sums of money flowing into them, leaving average voters with little to no influence at all. So, let's compare a political action committee, a PAC, with a super PAC. The biggest and most important difference between the pair is who can contribute and in how much they can give. Candidates in traditional candidate committees can accept $2,700 from individuals each election cycle. And there are two election cycles in a year, one for primary, the other for the general election in November. That means they can take in a maximum of $5,400 a year, half in the primary, half in the general. Candidates in traditional candidate committees are prohibited from accepting money from corporations, unions, and associations. Federal election code prohibits those entities from contributing directly to candidates or to candidate committees. Super PACs, on the other hand, have no limitations on who contributes to them or how much they can spend on influencing an election. They can raise as much money from corporations, unions, and associations as they please and spend unlimited amounts on advocating for the election or defeat of the candidates of their choice. In other words, they can buy advertising, and they do. They spend tens of millions of dollars, and it's not the candidate doing that. It's a super PAC. Also, super PACs, in some cases, don't have to reveal sources of contributions. Now, in summary, the big question, the big kahuna, where's the grim reaper in all of this? How do we stop this crazy spending on elections to assure elected candidates are those best qualified for the job, and not just the one with the most connected campaign funding sources? Let's get rid of super PACs. But since the Supreme Court already ruled in Citizens United that cannot happen, how can we rid the system of those super PACs legally? The answer is simple. Got to have a new law. But who makes those new laws? Congress makes all laws. And the fact that members of Congress are the chief beneficiaries of super PACs, it's going to be tough at best to get them to pass a law that will pass muster with the Supreme Court and stop super PACs from operating. In the interim, I suggest you pay close attention to all those who run for elections that directly impact you. That's from the White House on down, Congress, your state, your city. When you find a candidate with whom you agree, get the facts of their campaign contributions and their contributors. If those dollars come chiefly from super PACs, be cautious. Folks, sad to say, there's no panacea for this. Americans need to pressure members of Congress to write new laws that address each of the reasons for the Supreme Court's overturn of Citizens United. And that needs to happen now. It's too late for 2020. But guess what? 2 years, another election. The Grim Reaper gleefully looks in using money to change our lives to be the way he wants them to be, using political influence, with no regard of what's right or what you or I think. We promise not to let coronavirus get us centered on just one thing and forget about everything else. And we haven't forgotten about coronavirus. It is critical. It's very important that we are all armed with facts. Tomorrow, we'll give you an update for this point in the week on the latest information, truthful information about the coronavirus. So make sure you're here tomorrow. We're here every day, folks. Look forward to seeing you tomorrow at Truth News Network, truthnewsnet.org. So long.
When madness is the norm, the truth is a radical act of courage. Remain calm. Be brave. Wait for the signs. TNN, the Truth News Network.